everybody. Welcome to Theater Schmooze from Alliance for Jewish Theater, where we chat with Jewish theater makers from around the world about their art, Judaism, and vision for theater's future. I'm your host, Danielle Levski. This podcast is brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater, a nonprofit organization made up of theater artists, theaters, and other people connected to theater to promote the creation, presentation, and preservation of both traditional and non-traditional theatrical endeavors by, for, and about the Jewish experience. Today, we'll be talking with Hadar Gelron, who is a playwright, actress, director, screenwriter, songwriter, and comedian based in Ramat Gan, near Tel Aviv, in Israel. It is such an honor to have you as a guest in our show, Hadar.
Hi, Laila Tov. Here it's midnight. I don't know what time it is by you.
It's about 2 p.m. here in San Diego, California. So we've still got daylight.
Okay, I'll be turning into a pumpkin any moment.
Perfect. Well, you do everything under the sun. So if you turn into a pumpkin, that's not quite a surprise, is it?
No, I don't do windows.
Right. No windows, no floors. Yes.
Right.
So I'm so excited to have you here today.
I'm glad to be here too.
You recently premiered your play, Jewish Enough for Hitler, in the Czech Republic.
Right.
And before then, the National Theater of Prague was home to your play, Mikva.
Right.
And I noticed that you often write about and perform about gender, sexuality, identity, femininity, religious observance. In your recent interview for the Jewish Chronicle, you said, "Identity and who I am has been a big part of my life. Am I an Israeli or am I a foreigner? For the unorthodox, I am the religious artist, but for the religious, I am the rebel." So I'm curious to know now, not from how others perceive your identity, but how you perceive your identity. What does being Jewish mean to you today?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, I'll begin with my identity. I think that an outsider was something that I can identify with from a very young age. But at a young age, it seemed to me to be a kind of block, to be a kind of stick in the wheels kind of thing. But today, I look at this block as a step, as a stepping stone, as a privilege to be able to see things also from the outside and not only from the inside. And I do feel today that although I am in many cases an outsider, I can choose. I can be inside. I can be outside. It's kind of like, you know, when you're playing this video game, and on the one hand you're on the joystick, and on the other hand you're this little man running in the video game. So I'm kind of aware of being in both places. My Jewishness is actually a very deep part of me. And I think that I'm falling more and more in love with my Jewishness, the less religious I am.
Yes.
The less it has to do with all these punishments and list of do's and don'ts and God's wrath. No, I feel closer to God without all the big threats. And I realize that, you know, maybe the relationship between belief and religion is like the relationship between love and marriage. Marriage as religion is a kind of vessel used for something, you know, much larger. The energy of love or the energy of belief is much larger than these vessels. And so I traded my religion for belief, I think.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
How do you feel that theater or film or any of the creations you make play into that as a vessel?
Well, it's there all the time. And I do use writing and directing and creating as part of investigating myself and my identity and where I'm from and people and psychology. It's always there. Even when I do write a lot about Jewish themes, but not always. But even when I don't, it's there as well. It's just a big part of who I am. And I was born into a very religious family. Mm-hmm. Today, I still have some siblings who are ultra-Orthodox. I mean, my brother-in-law, it's not that he won't speak to me. He won't look at me. So if he does happen to be speaking to me, I will just have to understand that he's looking at the wall and this is meant for me. And I'm like, oh, yes, hi to you too, kind of thing. I don't take it personally. It's his problem.
That's good. That's a healthy relationship to have.
Yes, very, very healthy.
So speaking of your background and producing work that investigates your stories, I wanted to talk about your earlier produced work, specifically Bedorka Halacha and Pulsa, which focused on and challenged your experiences in the more religious Jewish world. So Pulsa in particular was banned from certain communities, but ultimately you received 700 performances in the Israeli theater scene, which is incredible. And I have to know, when you were creating and performing these shows, leading up to it, did you anticipate those kinds of reactions, the reactions from the Orthodox Jewish world, the reactions from the greater Jewish world at large?
Well, that was a big surprise for me, actually, because I was sure I was going to be cast out of many Orthodox circles. But actually, I suddenly became aware of a huge feminist religious kind of wave. And I was hugged and brought into many circles, whilst on the other hand, I had like life threats on my phone. And I found it all quite amusing, by the way. You know, I still do perform with Passion Killer, and I have a kind of, when I perform abroad, it's kind of a mixture of Passion Killer and Pulsa. And even like performances just 2 years ago, I was going to say last year, then I remembered we lost 1 year with COVID. But 2 years ago, I had a performance in the UK and in Prague for the Jewish community, a stand-up comedy. And only when I got to Prague, I realized what had happened in Ireland, because in Ireland, just like a few hours before the show, they were telling me, oh, but don't do this and don't do that. And what exactly? And I said, we've had this contract for this show for months. And now a few hours before the show, you want to change everything. What happened? What happened? No, the rabbi said this. What does the rabbi know? Has the rabbi seen my show? Has he? And I did actually change a lot of things, but there was a very small audience. And I thought to myself, I came all the way to Dublin, this horrible weather, just for the, you know, for this show that about 30 people turned up. And they were actually people who wanted to see the more kind of sharp-edged stuff, but I didn't do it in the end. And I just did one of the pieces from the cutting-edge stuff. And I said, yeah, the rest is kind of more parva, more cautious, because I got instructions and this show was invited by the Jewish community. Then when I got to Prague, the hall was packed and the wife of the rabbi was in the hall too. And she came to me at the end of the show and she said that she actually really liked the show and she liked the message. Yeah, there were some places where she felt her stomach turn upside down for a minute, but on the whole, she felt that it was done with so much love that there was no harm in listening. And I said to her, what made you come in the end? Because I remembered I'd sent her an invitation and she said she doesn't think she'll be able to make it. She said, well, actually, we got some letters from the rabbinate in Jerusalem saying, do not let this woman perform she will corrupt the minds of your community. And then I realized what had happened in Ireland as well. And I thought, oh my goodness, corrupt the minds. Now that the ambassador, Daniel Meron, he was then ambassador, Israeli ambassador in the Czech Republic. He was there with me when we were speaking to David Peter's wife. And he said to me, doesn't it scare you? I said, actually, I'm quite flattered. You know, I think of this rabbi in the rabbinate in Jerusalem, where all his only job is to just sit and look where Hadal Garon's little performances around the world are. And I said, I find that really, really intriguing.
Have you ever had contact with that rabbinate?
I don't know. I don't know where it came from, who's sending out these letters. Mm. If he's listening, then hi. But no, I don't have any time to go looking for these people who are bored.
Oh, sure thing, of course.
I would do the windows before that.
Oh, yes. First the windows. I suppose I'm curious to know, in those instances where you feel like you've had to censor parts of your performances, what ultimately led you to the decision to comply or to deny it?
Well, I'll tell you, I think, first of all, when I was in Ireland, if they would have spoken to me a week before, I might have cancelled because it was really far-fetched. I felt that they were speaking out of fear. And you know, it seemed to me, yeah, I don't know. They ordered something and now they don't want it. But, you know, I'm already here. I was already in Ireland. And what's going on? But when I perform, even for religious communities here in Israel, I sometimes even censor myself because I think the message is greater than the details. So I like walking on the edge, but for each community, the edge is somewhere different. So when I perform in a theater and people buy tickets to see the show, then I go all the way. And, you know, I'm really glad if someone gets up and wants to leave in the middle of the show. I say if I haven't annoyed at least one person, then I haven't done my job properly. And normally when someone does make it for the door, I stop them on the way and I say, oh, should I wait for you? Are you leaving or are you just going to the WC or what? You know, just tell me, you know, is it the babysitter? I love arguing with the audience. I love because I know that I have enough sources to answer any question.
Yeah.
Because I really did a long research on women's status in Jewish law and on everything that I put into the show. Actually, before COVID, there was one show in the Camry and it was a Haredi couple. And they were, you know, really Haredi. And the guy had long side locks and the woman had a few head coverings. You know, they have not just one, but a few. And they were standing on the side waiting. And I said to the pianist, don't leave me alone with this couple, okay? Just stay around. Because I saw they were waiting to speak to me privately. And then after everyone else had left, I saw the woman giving her cell phone to her husband and she gets towards me. And I thought, oh my God, what, you know, now it's going to. And I looked to see that the pianist was still there. And she says to me, can I have a picture with you? And I'm, what? And I see myself in my mind's eye. I see myself in a wanted sign, dead or alive. I said, where are you going to put it? And then she begins telling me, I agree with everything you say. And it's really important. We need to have more people to speak up like you. And then her husband starts adding in more things. You should say this and you should say that. You should add this. I said, whoa. I'm doing my part. You say that. You go forward. Use this as a, you know, one end of a stick. And I did even have an offer after Mikveh went on stage in Israel, together with the threats on my life and the threats on my next life as well, by the way. There are people who know that I will not be going to heaven. There was also a group of Haredi women who wanted me to lead a political party. And they even had finance for it. And I just said, no, I'm not going into politics. I'm not good at politics. I'm good at theater. So, you know, take I did arrive at the Knesset and did have a speak at the Knesset. And I do voluntary talks and shows for Haredi or communities that want me specifically to come. Or sometimes it's communities of people who are kind of in between. They want to leave Haredi society, but they don't find themselves in secular society. And I'm going back to that place where I need to remind myself and remind other people that, you know, there is God that created man, but there are also many, many gods that were created by man. And those gods are idols, even if the people are Haredi. You know, on the belts of the SS soldiers, there was a stamp, Gott mit uns, God is with us. So people use God to do the horriblest things. And that's not the God. That's not my God, anyway.
Yeah. It's interesting that across most religions and spiritualities, there is a lot of talk of what God is and should be, and yet no one has actually, there has been no God presence amongst us that actually has been able to confirm or deny any of those things. But yeah, religion has been often used to justify.
Well, I have news for you. You can call me Hadar.
I have some questions. So we left off on a very interesting discussion of God and your experiences with the Haredi community, people being surprising and also not surprising at the same time. Something that I've noticed in your discussions as a woman and your experiences in the Orthodox world, but also your experiences doing research as a woman in Judaism, I noticed that you said for this quote in the Pitt News, which is actually my alma mater, which is great. You said, "I felt I was growing up in a space where everything I wanted was considered impossible. Everything I wanted to do is, no, you can't do that because you're a girl." Hadar, you mentioned feminism a little bit earlier. Would you consider yourself a feminist? And what does that word mean to you?
The word feminism does have so many negative connotations today as well. So I will first define what I mean. I think that feminism is, for me, equal chances. And when I say equal chances, I mean I want my daughter and my sons to have the same chances. When I grew up, it wasn't, nothing was obvious. As you said before, everything I wanted, it was kind of out of my reach. I had to fight for it. I don't want my daughter to have to fight for it. But you know, this fighting for it was also part of my way, because my older sister, who is today Haredi, she once said to me when we met one Shabbat when I was studying theater instead of law, I left my law studies and I didn't begin them. I just signed up and then I transferred it to theater. And she said to me, "I'm really jealous of you." And I said to her, "You're jealous of me? How come? I mean, my whole life I've been hearing, why can't you be like Orly? Why can't you be like Orly? Why can't I even asked myself a few times, why can't I be like Orly? And what are you jealous of?" And she said to me, "Well, in the end, you do whatever you want." And I'd never thought of my life like that until that moment. It really changed something for me, because I'd always thought, as you said before, everything I want, I cannot have. But then it made me think of myself differently. It made me give myself a completely different narrative of my life until that point. Mm-hmm. And that's also, by the way, something I do. I have these workshops of teaching people how to change narratives. Narratives of a single person, of ourselves, or narratives of a nation. Because we say we can't change our past, but we can change our past. We can change our perspective of our past, and like that, we're changing our future. So from that moment, something inside me clicked and really made me be much less of a victim of anything and much more of, yeah, whatever I want, I need to, maybe if I need to fight for it, okay, I'll fight for it, but I'll get it.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful way to reframe the past for the present and for the future. So right now, and we were talking about this a little bit at the beginning of our conversation, COVID keeps complicating all of our plans. Mm-hmm. As theater artists, as humans, as people who just want to connect with other people, it's hard to continuously reframe the past when the present is so unknowable and when the future is so undefined. You once said in that same article I mentioned earlier with Jewish Currents, "It's time for us to be the leading role in our lives. We need to dare to be." So what advice would you give to listeners today who need to step back on the stage, need to re-enter that leading role?
That article, by the way, was just a couple of months ago when I performed in London against all odds. I was in London with Whistle, and also in the Czech Republic with Whistle and with Jewish Enough for Hitler. Whistle is the monodrama which has a lot to do with Jewishness, but nothing to do with Judaism. And it's something I wrote together with Yaakov Butchan, whose mother was Mengele's secretary. And why am I saying this now? I'm saying it because it's kind of a pathway to answer your question of how are we dealing with all the things that happen to us in life are also an opportunity and also a gateway to something else. And, you know, I think that what COVID made me do is to keep focused on what I want, but to try to let go of the how, to try to let go of control, which is difficult because, you know, during COVID, I also got divorced. It was done in, I think, the friendliest way possible and with a lot of compassion, but still it's a difficult step. And, you know, everything was kind of, who am I? What am I? Maybe I should have studied law. I did have all the questions, but I went back to my intuitive place because sometimes our intuition is disturbed by fear. And I've done a lot of courses on, you know, Theta healing and Reiki, and I studied Kabbalah, and I'm very connected also to spirituality in this way. And I just felt that I needed to put the fear aside, stop listening to the news so much. You know, it's enough to hear once a day just to get the headlines and see what's going on, not to be addicted to fear, because that's what the media does to us, and to go back to intuition, to base, to nature, and try to let go. I mean, do what I can, but try to let go. So I was writing more for TV, and my neshuma is in theater, definitely. I find now that the gates are slowly opening again. I did actually find myself going abroad. I was, I think, the only person in Israel, more or less, going abroad when there was a strong lockdown. I had a letter from the Minister of Culture in the Czech Republic who said that I am essential. I said, okay, I have it here written. I am essential. You will not convince me I'm not essential.
Yes.
No, there were, I'm not saying there were not some really, how to call it, I don't know, fretful days and nights. But I think that the way of overcoming that is just like letting go and seeing the what, but not the how, letting go of the how. And that's where belief is for me. You know, it's a big test of, okay, do I believe that I'm in the right path? Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
So that's my way of dealing with it.
Oh, wonderful. So let go of fear, everybody. That's the big message.
Oh yeah, fear is our biggest enemy.
True. Well, thank you for being so brave and joining us today and sharing your stories and the messages and the challenges you've gone through to create such an illustrious career for yourself.
Well, thank you very much. And and I always say, what doesn't kill me makes me laugh. So it's also a good way of looking at life.
That's very true. Yes. Thank you, Hadar.
Thank you.
That was a well-needed laugh. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into Theater Schmooze. A special thanks to Danny Debner and Jeremy Aluma, our producers, Ilya Levinson and Alex Kaufman, the composers of our theme music, Michelle Shapiro, the creator of our logo, and the entire Alliance for Jewish Theater community. This podcast was brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater. If you like what you've heard today, support this podcast and all of our initiatives towards connecting Jewish theater makers by making a tax-deductible donation to Alliance for Jewish Theater at alljewishtheater.org or joining as a member. Make sure to give us a review on iTunes and follow Alliance for Jewish Theater on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming Jewish theater events, group meetings, and news in our world. I'm Danielle Levski, and I'll see you next time. L'chaim.